Welcome to the 2009-802.11n Wi-Fi Challenge at WebTorials, where we are discussing what is needed to create a high availability environment in 802.11n. I'm Robin Leyland, an analyst in the networking industry and host of the challenge series at WebTorials. Joining me is Joni Wexler. Joni is a writer and analyst, the author of the Network World Wireless in the Enterprise newsletter, and a longtime observer of the wireless industry. Joni will be leading the discussions. Welcome, Joni.
Thanks, Robin.
Joining us to discuss how to create a high availability environment is Mark Calton, Director of Marketing at Trapeze Networks. Welcome, Mark.
Good afternoon, Robin and Joni.
Also participating is Kevin Goulet from Motorola. Kevin is a Senior Director of Marketing in Motorola's Enterprise Wireless LAN Group. Welcome, Kevin.
My pleasure. Great to be here today.
I'm now going to turn the session over to Joni, who's going to ask our first question.
Thank you, Robin, and thank you, Mark and Kevin, for joining me today to discuss a pretty relevant topic for 802.11n networks. High availability seems like it is going to become very important as 802.11n allows enterprises to actually consider all wireless LAN access networks. So what I'd like to start with is defining high availability and the various elements that contribute to it in an 802.11n wireless LAN system. I believe there are both wireless and wired components that would be relevant. Kevin, would you like to start and give us your take on the various elements for high availability in 11n?
Sure, Joan. Happy to. A good percentage of our customers at Motorola are looking to run their networks as a primary network, no longer a secondary overlay network, which has historically been the case with wireless. When they're running in such a manner, we definitely recommend a high availability implementation. And the elements around that we recommend to customers are clearly a redundant switch in the data center or clusters of switches, depending on the size of the implementation. We recommend an adaptive AP, which I'll talk to you more about as we go on, but it's a unique AP that Motorola brings to market that can function autonomously as well as dependently. And that by itself, in the way we've architected it, brings another level of resiliency into the network, into the operation, that allows business to keep going in the face of multiple paths of failure. And we also recommend additional radios, perhaps in the access point, that can act as mesh backup radios. What I mean by that, Joni, is if, for example, a wired link were to go down, connecting a specific AP, what our adaptive AP with an additional mesh radio will do is light up its dormant mesh radio, find another access point that's perhaps connected to a different wired port that is still running, create a secure encrypted tunnel, mesh tunnel, between those two access points, and therefore be able to carry the traffic back through that access point that's connected to a different port that's still running. Again, maintaining resiliency in the underlying devices or laptops that are run off that AP. So those are the primary three areas that we focus on for a high availability implementation.
Okay, great. And we'll come back to some of those specifics having to do with configuration that you began talking about. Mark from Trapeze, just wondering, are you in fairly high agreement with Kevin about the various elements of high availability for 11N, or are there other pieces to the puzzle that we should also bring up?
Yeah, I think he's missed out a few things. You know, we have dual homing on all of our APs so that the AP can fail over to another controller if you had, let's say, a power outage on the PoE port, or there was some breakage or problem with the Ethernet cable. Also, all the controllers have got multiple backhauls into the network, so you can do link aggregation and also dual home those to different LAN switches. Obviously, you've got to have redundant power on all the controllers. I'm sure we're going to get into our cluster controller virtualization approach So I won't, you know, won't go into that right now. But
Mark,
you know,
when you say multiple backhauls, what did you mean by that?
I'm talking about, you know, gigabit Ethernet connections from your controller into the LAN switches, so that you know, if one of the upstream LAN switches fails, the core switch that your WLAN controller is connected to, you know, it doesn't matter whether the controller's alive, but if the network, part of the network fails, then you've also lost your wireless that way, right?
So are you talking about then perhaps dual homing controllers to disparate Ethernet switches?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Just wanted to clarify that. Thanks.
Yeah. You know, running 802.1Q and all those things that, you know, all the standard networking protocols that you'd expect. But one thing that everybody seems to forget about is how you provide services such as guest access. You know, a common way that guest access is implemented involves putting guest records actually into the controllers. And so if a controller fails, you also lose guest security information. Our approach is different because we have a centralized guest access server, which doesn't involve having any guest records in the controllers.
Okay, let's come back to that. First of all, Kevin, did you want to respond to anything that Mark said before we move on to maybe some nitty-gritty questions about what happens when certain things fail in the end-to-end network?
Joni, what I would state, I think our terminology might be different. What Mark had indicated is very analogous to what I discussed as well. Multi-homing is just another way of talking about a redundant switch in the data center, for example. What we also do is, of course, recommend, now back into the wired side, multi-homing IP, which of course would provide more redundancy if an IP, you know, in a very high availability implementation, provides the user or the enterprise far more redundancy in the case of an IP outage. We actually take that one more step further, which I didn't talk about, but I think in this context I will, Joni, and that is we actually offer in a number of our wireless controllers or switches an expansion card that will take basically a 3G or a 4G data card and provide yet another means of carrying the traffic back. We'll utilize this card in this slot can utilize the cellular data network as a redundant path back to the Internet and back to, obviously, wherever that origin of data is coming from. So we provide even that level of redundancy for users who just simply can't be, you know, without connectivity.
Mark, anything like that in the trapeze architecture?
No, I think these are a little bit overkill. I mean, you know, talking about mesh APs, you know, having a third radio in a mesh AP, can you imagine the premium of cost when you're deploying a network of 200, 300 APs? That's just completely cost prohibitive.
Now, that being said, anybody have any numbers we can put to this kind of thing? Now, as we know, high availability as well as security, there's always this slippery slope of trade-off as to how much do you want to invest versus how much can you afford to lose if you're down for a second or a minute or an hour. Can anybody talk to the trade-off, the cost-benefit trade-off of what you invest versus how much you protect yourself? Mark, would you like to start that conversation off?
Yes, the answer is to have a redundancy approach within the wireless network itself that is so robust that you don't need to go ahead and come up with other contrived methods of mesh APs and 3G backhauls. I mean, realistically, how much capacity is a 3G backhaul going to give me? It's trivial. If I can bring my network back up in a few milliseconds, why is that going to be of value to me, having a 3G backhaul?
Okay, I'm going to change over to Kevin. I was wondering if you could respond, number one, to the cost issue that Mark broached with a configuration that has multiple built-in failover capabilities.
Certainly, Joni, happy to. The couple of questions that Mark raised I would like to address. The cost associated with high availability networks needs to be looked at on a full installed basis. Mark brought up an interesting point. The cost of a second radio, mesh radio, is not cost prohibitive whatsoever. In fact, in a number of our implementations, we are providing a second radio for the price of a single radio AP. And we're doing that for another reason. And that reason is not only the redundancy in a wired infrastructure implementation in the high availability, we're also utilizing that second radio to carry traffic back utilizing the wireless network. So where the cost savings begin to really add up there is as you migrate to N, for example, as opposed to plugging yet another wireless infrastructure on top of a wired infrastructure, we're advising customers, and they're moving down the road with us, actually running an all-wireless network, not only utilizing the access points to connect to the laptops or the mobile computers or the devices, but using that same wireless network to carry the traffic back to the data center. That in itself brings a whole new level of cost advantage to an enterprise that a wired wireless overlay system can never come close to matching. Second part about Mark's point added around the 3G cellular data card and how limited bandwidth that would be. Don't disagree. Technically, that's a more limited backhaul. However, he also made the assumption that he could turn his network back on in a couple of milliseconds. I think that's not a fair assumption in some specific instances, in a lot of instances. If you lost your internet, if you lost a T1 or you lost a carrier IP, T1 or IP to your facility, it may be a lot longer, and I know a lot of our customers and the ones listening today have had a lot longer outages than a couple of milliseconds. If that's the case, that network's dead. This at least provides you a method to carry critical data and critical information back to keep your business up and running.
Mark, what do you have to say about that?
I somewhat disagree with the rationale that if you've got, a small satellite office that, if it's so mission critical that that satellite office is able to communicate, that you would rely on one T1 or one internet connection in the first place. What is the cost of having two DSL lines or one cable and one DSL line into a small office? It's very, very small. If you lose your internet connection, you've got bigger problems than if you're losing wireless connectivity to your clients.
And Mark,
as for the two radio or three radio, I kind of got lost because I thought Kevin was talking about a three radio device. Everyone's got two radio APs, and most people can do meshing as well with two radios. So I don't understand quite what his differentiator is that he's claiming. But I think we're getting into the weeds. There's a much bigger issue than AP redundancy, which is, controller-level redundancy when you're trying to roam around the building in the middle of a voice call. What happens?
Well, thank you for bringing that up, because I'd kind of like to step back, and if we could maybe walk through, we've already addressed some of the issues about an access point failure, but let's start at the wireless radio access network, the wireless LAN, and kind of walk through the network segments and talk about what happens in your respective systems if there's a failure. So let's just start at the beginning. If an access point should fail, what are some alternatives for what would happen in, for example, a Motorola network?
Sure, Joni, thank you. So,
and I know some of this will be repetitive. That's okay.
Right, right. In the case of an access point failure in a Motorola network, built into our controllers, our switches, is a tool called SmartRF. SmartRF is sensing and able to identify a down access point. And what we do in that case is once that is identified, automatically our controller will boost the power of the access points surrounding that downed access point, in effect filling the hole, if you will, that will obviously then keep business running underneath or in close proximity to that access point because it's basically filled in automatically. So that's the first step in the case of a downed access point.
And Mark, does Trapeze have? I'm going to call that dynamic transmit power control. Is that accurate?
Yes, we talked about this the other day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have the same thing. In a catastrophic scenario, it will automatically adjust. In a non-catastrophic scenario, it will make sure that the power settings are not power settings or channels are not adjusted until all voice calls on going through that AP have been completed. Obviously the client, in the event of a AP failure, the client's job is to go and roam to the nearest AP it can find, and that's just standard LA 2.11 stuff. So depending on, what security protocols are being used and whether or not you're doing cross-controller roaming in that search for a new AP, you may or may not need to authenticate with most systems. With our system, you'll never need to re-authenticate because of the technologies we use with mobility domain, which I mentioned the other day.
So, Kevin, what capabilities does Motorola offer to protect voice sessions in the case of an access point failure?
Great. So what Motorola does, Joni, is we actually developed a number of the algorithms that have since become standard in the 802.11 and standard in the 802.11 standard, around voice. We provided those to the standards body because we think that that will result in a better industry and a better quality of service across the board. However, let me talk to your specific question. In the case of an access point that fails while connecting a voice call, voice over WLAN call, what needs to happen here is specifically what we put in the standard and is now commonplace, and that is an uptick immediately. First of all, fast roaming so that call can be handed off immediately to a neighboring AP. But, of course, to maintain that quality of service and reduce packet loss, which can happen in a slower transition or a slow transition without a power kick up of neighboring access points to provide the right level of signal, you will lose packets. The standard in our application will allow that to happen seamlessly while maintaining that quality of service. One other area, Joni, I will bring up, Motorola does have a voice over WLAN device, phones actually, in addition to our wireless LAN offering. And in there, we can maintain the absolute highest quality of service with yet another algorithm that we put in the handset, talks directly to our access points to ensure those handoffs, even in the face of AP failure, are even more seamless than in a standard non-Motorola handset.
Does that proprietary algorithm have a name?
It does, although it's not something that we're bringing to market. We have our own internal engineering name for it. I'll put it to you that way. But
okay.
It's super fast roaming.
Super fast roaming. Okay.
Correct.
Okay. Mark, how does this compare with Trapeze?
Yeah, let's just get a reality check on the standards here. Fast roaming is part of the 802.11i standard. And, it basically is very helpful in intra controller roaming. So when you're roaming from one AP to another that are being managed by the same controller, great. You don't have to go and re-authenticate. You have virtually zero packet loss, and everything's wonderful. It's when you're doing cross-controller roaming that everything seems to break down. And this is where Trapeze has a big advantage. In fact, we just got, just this week, we were awarded a patent on this very topic. Let me see if I can remember what the thing was called. System and method for distributing keys in a wireless network. And, you know, if you know anything about how long it takes to get patents approved, it's clear that we've had this technology for many, many years. And what this does is basically give you seamless roaming across controllers within what we call a mobility domain, which is up to 64 controllers. So imagine you've got 192 access points on every controller. We're talking about massive, massive networks giving you totally seamless mobility, the same level of mobility that other vendors only offer when you're roaming between access points on the same controller.
Kevin, how does Motorola handle user reauthentication when the user roams between controllers? In other words, from AP to AP, when the two APs are connected to different controllers at the back end.
Great question, Joni, and I'm glad you brought that up. So Motorola's approach to this is, first of all, we utilize clusters of controllers. Those clusters do not require inter-controller roaming, as Mark alludes to in the Trapeze implementation. There is no need for that. Fundamentally, we've found a way of solving that problem without making it apparent or having to do workarounds that the customer needs to be aware of. So fundamentally, I think Mark's solving a problem that we solved long ago, and as a result, up with clusters of switches up to 2060 plus, we're able to maintain that same quality of service that Mark's talking about on one controller AP to AP roam. So we've solved that problem many years ago with our architecture.
So it sounds like both of you use clustering technology at the controller level for some virtualization. Kevin, is it fair to say there's virtualization going on in your
yes, yes, that's a very Joni, that's a very simplistic way of thinking about it. That is mm-hmm. accurate, correct?
Okay. So basically, I'm wondering how the two architectures really differ. They sound very similar. Mark, do you have any thoughts?
I'm not really sure what Kevin's describing. Certainly, he is misrepresenting what I said. I was talking about we can roam across multiple controllers in sub 50 milliseconds in exactly the same way as other vendors roam within a controller, across APs within a controller in sub 50 milliseconds. So we're doing this, campus-wide. Maybe they're able to do the same thing and they have their own technique similar to ours for doing so. Maybe.
Okay, given what we've discussed about the clustering capabilities at the back end of both of your architectures, I'm not sure if this question remains relevant or not, but do you recommend salt and pepper redundancy configurations? What I'm talking about there is alternatingly cabling an access point nearby access points to alternate controllers at the back end, such that if one controller should fail, not all access points in a given cell would die. So let me ask, do you recommend this kind of cabling in your own architectures? Why or why not? And let's start with Mark.
Okay, in the Trapeze architecture, we don't recommend it, and it adds no value and it's completely unnecessary. And there are a number of reasons for this. One, there is no fixed association between an AP and any one controller.
Yeah.
Because with our virtual controller cluster approach, as APs and controllers get added or moved or anything changes in the network, we offer completely dynamic AP load balancing. So at one point in time, an AP may be managed by controller A, and then at another point in time, it may be managed by controller B. So there is no hard, fast association. In other architectures, not trapeze, it's quite possible that this approach, although it's intended to reduce the risk of a client not finding an available AP if a controller were to fail, in those other architectures, there is also a penalty, because if you're a pacer and you're walking up and down the hallway on the phone, each time you go from one AP to another, you're also crossing controllers, and unless you've got the same kind of fast roaming across controllers that we have, chances are you would have to re-authenticate, and then you would notice that in the quality of the voice call. That's why it's not good for some architectures, but as far as our architecture is concerned, it's kind of an irrelevant question, because it doesn't apply. There are no penalties either way if you were to try to do that.
Okay, I understand. I think you've been clear with your response. Kevin, what about Motorola? Is it a similar situation there? What do you recommend in terms of salt and pepper? Irrelevant, important, not a good idea?
So, Joni, Motorola recommends that really the implementation is the important part, and we provided flexibility on our architecture to go either way. A number of IT folks will espouse by salt and pepper, and what we've done to accommodate that and work very, very smoothly and perfectly well with that implementation is we've developed our authentication algorithm to allow a pacer, perhaps Mark brings up a good issue in this type of implementation, a pacer to walk up and down the hallway and by virtue of the salt and pepper architecture, bounce from one controller to the next. The way we've enabled that, where there's no penalty or downside in our implementation, is we've architected our controllers to after the first authentication, to keep authentication for that specific device for 30 minutes. So you simply can walk up and down the hall all day without re-authenticating after that first authentication on the switch or the controller. On the flip side, we also recommend a hot standby type of approach where the main controller or controllers, depending if they're clustered, will manage and carry that traffic, and the hot standby switch or controller can be there waiting for any potential failure mode, at which point we can traverse all the traffic over to the hot standby switch and maintain that high availability. So the quick answer, Joni, is we will work in either scenario. We don't recommend one over the other necessarily, but we can work just as smoothly with both implementations.
Okay, great.
May I just comment on that?
Certainly.
Because Kevin mentioned the need for a hot standby or the possibility of having a hot standby. We don't need such a thing. All of our controllers are providing redundancy to all other controllers simultaneously. At any point, if any one of the controllers that is in the cluster were to fail, all calls, all sessions are immediately mapped over to, or rather, all the APs are immediately reassigned to other controllers that are in the cluster. So there's no need for an idle hot standby device at all. Our virtual clustering approach isn't just about easy configuration. It's about easy configuration. It's about instant failover and about dynamic load balancing, not just load balancing every 30 minutes or at some scheduled time. This is on-the-fly load balancing. So let's say you wanted to add a controller or you wanted to move an AP, the adjustments are made in real time.
Kevin, given what Mark has said, could you perhaps elaborate a bit on why you need a hot standby controller if you're in a clustered controller environment to begin with?
Okay, great. Joni, so I think we do need to maybe provide a little more clarity on this issue. Let's take a non-clustered scenario, and then I'll move to a clustered scenario. Let's simply take an organization that's able to run on one of our wireless controllers, our wireless switches, one switch. In the case of IP going down to that switch or someone unplugs the switch, whatever the case might be that would cause a hard failure, in a high availability situation, we would recommend another switch in another data center perhaps or another wiring closet, wherever that case might be, which is just simply good networking practice. At that point, all the traffic, all the sessions can be moved over seamlessly to that second standby controller. The second area, though, that I'd like to talk about, and I think it's just simply the differences in perhaps nomenclature or architecture that the two companies use here. When we cluster, Joni, we utilize our clustering in order to increase capacity. So I'll give you another example of a cluster where we might have three switches clustered together, basically tripling the capacity of a single switch. When we do that, of course, if there were a hard failure of that cluster of three switches without a cluster on hot standby that can handle all that capacity or at least the expected capacity at any point in time, there is no way to maintain that seamlessly. So that's why we recommend the cluster. And, of course, whenever you cluster and you're looking for high availability, you need to ensure that your standby solution, whether it's within an existing cluster or on a standby cluster, has enough capacity to handle the maximum amount of traffic that the system is designed for.
Good point. Well, as we can see, there are many, many feature, configuration, and capability issues to consider when thinking about a high availability environment for an all wireless network. We've barely scratched the surface here, but hopefully our discussion today will give listeners many things to think about and questions to ask as they go and pursue their own solutions. Thank you so much for joining me, Mark and Kevin, and appreciate all the comments.
Okay, I want to thank Joni for leading a very interesting session, and a special thanks to Mark and Kevin for the valuable input on building a high availability environment for 802.11n. This is just one of five discussions we have on 802.11n, so I encourage you to check out the other sessions. You can find all this and other information on the vendor solutions at the challenge page at WebTorials. I also want to encourage you to contact any of the sponsors for more information on this subject or any 802.11n topic, and especially give them a chance to explain how they can help you build a better wireless solution. Thank you.